6-month delay not only added rent and other expenses to his budget, he completely missed the Florida winter season. Rather than opening in November to capture it, Howard opened in March when the winter season was over and the snowbirds had flown up north. He missed his opportunity, lost even more money during the off-season, and closed before the next winter season even began. 2 years wasted and millions of dollars lost. Procrastination is completely unacceptable to me. In fact, to be honest, even a moderate pace is not acceptable to me. I'm all about pushing to get it done. Procrastination has both an emotional and a behavioral factor. We don't want to do something for a variety of reasons, and that translates into avoidance behaviors. Thoughts turn into actions or inactions in this case. Not doing what we know needs to get done could have a neurological component. Fuchsia Saroy of Bishop's University and Timothy Pitchell of Carleton University, both in Canada, found that procrastinators comfort themselves in the present with the false belief that they'll be more emotionally equipped to handle a task in the future. The future self becomes the beast of burden for procrastination, says Saroy. We're trying to regulate our current mood and thinking our future self will be in a better state. They'll be better able to handle feelings of insecurity or frustration with the task. That somehow we'll develop these miraculous coping skills to deal with these emotions that we just can't deal with right now. Pitchell adds, it's an existentially relevant problem because procrastination is not getting on with life itself. You only get a certain number of years. What are you doing? Good question. Your later self won't necessarily be more disciplined than your right now self. If you let yourself slack off now, you're building a habit of procrastination and actually making it less likely that your later self will get anything done. Accomplishments and achievements do not happen by mistake or by themselves. They are the result of a conscious effort to take action. Life is not a coincidence. Life is a consequence. Tony, a young man I met on a trip to the Midwest, told me about an idea he had for a business that would match individuals or families with the best pets for them. He worked at an animal shelter, and every day people would return pets or drop off ones they had purchased from a breeder or a pet store because the animal and the person or family did not mesh well. From his work with animals and people, he knew a way to find just the right type of pet for individual types of people. What a phenomenal idea! The business would reduce pet dumping, abuse, regret, and returns, and increase the happiness of both people and animals. He told me all about this great idea, but when I asked him what he had done to make it a reality, he told me he hadn't done any work yet. I'm going to start in the next few months, he said. Okay. When I was back in the Midwest a few months later, I ran into Tony and asked him about the progress he had made on the pet matching business. His answer? None. I'm starting next month, he said. I asked Tony how he spent his days. He began them like many of us do, by checking email and then logging onto Facebook, Twitter, Reddit, and Instagram for 5 minutes. Before he knew it, 2 hours had passed, and it was time for him to get to the shelter to work. When he got home at night, he'd have dinner with his family, watch the news, and check in on his favorite teams, either on TV or online. By that time, he was too tired to do anything else, so he'd veg out and promise himself that tomorrow he'd make headway on his business idea. The cycle repeated itself the next day and the day after that. Later was quickly becoming never. That's not going to work. To get anything done effectively and to combat procrastination, you need to put some firm practices into place. Here are a few ways I encourage people to stop making excuses and take control of their time. Spend the first 30 minutes of your day working, not checking. If you need to check email or your social news sites, do it only after you have established a good work groove. In Tony's case, he needed to get up in the morning and spend 30 minutes working on his business plan. To do so, he made sure the internet and email programs were turned off on his computer. Make a list and do the first thing on it. Starting anything new can be hard, but if you can get over that hump, you will gain momentum and be more likely to keep at it. One thing leads to another is an old saw for a reason. It's true. Lists are great for getting things done now, and you can thank something called the Zeigarnik effect, which states that unfinished tasks are more likely to get stuck in your memory. A to-do list calms the Zeigarnik effect and helps you check off the boxes more easily. Break down big jobs into small ones. Big tasks, starting a pet matching business, can be daunting and therefore easy to put aside for another time. Break the big job into smaller, finite ones. Tony's small tasks included coming up with a name for the business, a mission statement, and a list of required resources and materials. After that, he was on his way. Be nice. If you've already procrastinated, research shows you're more likely to get started on time this time if you show yourself compassion for past slacking phases and don't beat yourself up about them. That just increases the risk of procrastination. Remind yourself why you want to do it. If you struggle to get something done, spend some time reminding yourself why you want to do it and why it is so important. This was easy for Tony. Every day he saw people abandoning or returning pets they could not care for because they were bad matches. Assigning personal meaning to a task makes you more likely to tackle it and avoid procrastination. If the timing isn't right, figure out why and do it anyway. If you are putting off doing something and telling yourself that the time isn't right, ask yourself why. There could be a legitimate reason to put something off, but most of the time there isn't. You can always do something to move forward with a plan. Twitter creator Jack Dorsey had the idea for the social networking site in 2000. At the time, the technology that would help Twitter succeed was not a reality. Dorsey knew this because he did a very small-scale and low-risk version of Twitter that failed. However, the attempt also showed him that when the technology did exist, his idea would have merit. When that time came, he already had the groundwork in place and was able to hit the ground running. When you hear yourself saying, "I'm too busy for that. It takes too much time. If I do that, I won't have time for anything else. I have too much to do, so nothing gets done. Everything takes longer than I think it will. I'm stuck on how to prioritize. Too many people make too many demands on me, so I have no room for the things I want to do." It's time to lose your time excuse and stop bullshitting yourself. Evaluate yourself on output, not on activity. I have a colleague who would become very excited when starting a project. His enthusiasm was palpable. At the beginning, he would gather his materials, make lists, reach out to partners, make phone calls, a flurry of activity that made a whirling dervish look slow. Inevitably, as time went on, my friend's enthusiasm for the project would begin to wane. Tasks would remain unfinished, phone calls would go unreturned for days, and sometimes weeks. The project would sometimes be passed off to an underling to finish, and some projects would just remain undone in favor of the excitement of something new. There was no interest in completion, in the process that takes a brilliant idea to final product. My friend remained constantly busy, but his productivity was dismal. He would be the first to tell you how hard-working he was, but he had very little to show for it. He measured himself on activity, not on output. Baseball players get paid to hit the ball, not just swing at it. The same can be said of people who spend half the day answering emails and reading and engaging in social media. These are activities that can't be monetized. They don't result in anything concrete. Yet people spend so much of their day on these time sucks that they wonder why they are busy and never accomplish half of what they set out to do in a 12-hour period. When I wake up in the morning, I think about what I can do for the next few hours that will forward my career, get me closer to a professional or personal goal, or help me finish a project. Email, social media, and non-urgent phone calls can all wait until after I have accomplished the tasks that are the most profitable, such as going over shooting schedules and programming notes, looking at any pending contracts or potential business agreements, checking ratings and audience engagement statistics, and returning priority phone calls. You can move 100 pieces of paper every day, but if it doesn't make any money or get you closer to a goal, it is pointless busy work. Being active without accomplishing anything has real consequences, as I explained earlier. It's easy to get stuck in a pattern. Days, and then weeks, and then months, and even years pass, and before you know it, the strategic plan you've been thinking about has not been implemented, the novel you wanted to write remains just a thought, and the triathlon you wanted to run this year has come and gone. You never got to where you thought you were going. How many goals have you wanted to reach that still remain pipe dreams? I'm sure you have a to-do list. My guess is that it has a mix of items that range from the practical, pick up dry cleaning, buy dog food, to the timely, get the quarterly report done, pay taxes, to the lofty, write the screenplay, learn Italian. How many of these items do you check off at the end of the day? The dry cleaning and the dog food? Okay, great. Did they get you any closer to your real goals? You have to check in with yourself at the end of each day to see if you actually accomplished anything important. Did you have meaningful output, or were you busy all day running errands, pushing paper, and bitching about your workload to colleagues? We tend to get stuck on procedures and busy work, when we need to stop doing those things and work hard on our lives. If all day you are doing busy work, when do you find the time to better your situation? At what point do you start working on your life? You have to allocate time to make your life better, whether it's half an hour learning something new, as we talked about in the last chapter, or spending half an hour a day on the novel you want to write so that it will get done. If we allow errands to take over our future, we will have no future. All we have is today. We need to identify that just being in our lives is not enough. It's when we work on our lives that life improves. I know of a woman, Alana, who owns a framing shop in a very prosperous, populated town. Opening her own gallery and framing shop was a lifelong dream, and she did it. The business is running well, too, but now she's drowning in back orders. She tells me she is busy all day and cannot get to all her orders on time. Customers are starting to become frustrated. When I quizzed Alana more deeply and asked her what exactly she did the day before we spoke, she told me she made 10 phone calls, ordered 17 frames, read 47 emails, and responded to about half of them, deleting the other non-essential half, met with 3 customers and took their orders, ate lunch, ran an errand, looked at her social media pages, checked the news online, and framed 1 photograph. All of this was done between the time the shop opened at 10 a.m. and when it was closed at 5 p.m. Alana told me she was exhausted at the end of the day. I am sure she was tired, not least because she knew she did not do the framing that she wanted and needed to do. Not getting real stuff done hangs over your head like the sword of Damocles, and it is stressful, depressing, and tiring. Alana is in the business of framing, yet she managed to frame only 1 image during 1 day of work. She measured her day in terms of activity. I told her she needed to start measuring her output, not her activity. She needed to think about how many framings she could complete in 1 day, working the same hours she was already working. I told her to try an experiment. For 1 day, she should put everything except lunch on the back burner. Her task would be to go into work and frame as many pictures as she could using the state-of-the-art automated machinery she owns that makes cutting mats and assembling frames fairly quick work. The next day, she tried my strategy and managed to frame up 10 pictures. The day after that, she framed 12. She did this for a week, and by Saturday, she was nearly caught up on her back orders. Did any of the other activities suffer because she started measuring herself on output of her business's central function? No. The fact is, the activities that took all day, email, social media, phone calls, monitoring the news, could be accomplished in a matter of about 60 to 90 minutes. When she changed her thinking from activity to output, the way Alana spent her day shifted. I know many successful people who check email only once in the morning and once in the afternoon. They scan the news when they wake up and before they go to bed at night. They make phone calls for a certain limited amount of time in the morning and follow up in the afternoon during a prescribed period if necessary. In other words, they enhance their output with a routine and by valuing output over activity. They know what they need to get done to move their day and their career forward. All the rest is gravy. Balls in the air. Manage priorities, not errands. Like Alana, most of us don't have to work 15, 19, or 20 hours a day to meet our goals. We probably don't even have to work 12 hours a day. There are people who run billion-dollar businesses in 12 hours a day or less, go home to their families, and manage to get a good night's sleep. The major difference between an efficient person's day and your day is the ability to prioritize. I wake up 90 minutes before I have to leave my house so I can eat breakfast, check the news and email, and have some breathing room before I start the day. I'm dressed in 5 minutes because I know what I'm going to wear. My wardrobe is simple and prepared. I define each day by what I need to accomplish. I am priority-driven. I know what will take me forward and what will keep me stalled. Even if you have 20 different things going on, you may not necessarily have to cut back on them to be efficient. You just have to figure out what your priorities are on a daily basis because it's unlikely that you can work on all 20 tasks in one day, or work on them very effectively. Brian Wansink directs the Cornell Food and Brand Lab. He coined the term mindless eating and wrote a bestseller by the same name. He describes mindless eating as a kind of overeating caused by distractions, among which he includes certain types of packaging, the colors and lighting around us, even family and friends. I think we can describe mindless activity in the same way. It's stuff you do when you're not really paying attention and under the influence of outside factors that distract you or people who don't always have your best interests in mind. Instead of allowing yourself to binge on junk activity as opposed to junk food, which you should not binge on either, shift your thinking from time management to priority management. I think of all the things I have to get done as balls. I might have 20 balls, but only 5 are really important on any given day. I have to move those 5 balls every day. After a certain number of days, I will push those balls over the finish line, and another 5 will take their place. If I can move each of those balls each day, I am progressing my life and my agenda. If those balls don't move, I'm not moving. I wake up energized by the ball that will be hardest to move and excited about the one easiest to move. Winners go for the tough balls first. One of my major balls is getting Bar Rescue done in a tight time frame. We used to shoot an entire episode in 5 days with 36 hours for remodeling within those 5 days. Now we shoot the entire episode in 4 days, still with 36 hours for remodeling. We arrive at a location in the afternoon for a 2-hour session that is filmed, and then we have 2 full days to fully rebrand and renovate the bar. On the 4th day, shooting is completed by the afternoon, which ends with the reveal and a reopening of the new bar. Essentially, I have only 2 full days and 2 half-days to turn a place around. That includes retraining staff, cleaning, fixing anything that is broken, renovating the concept and any branding, and recipe development. There are many parts to the effort. In the time crunch we face, understanding which balls are important and which ones are less so is crucial. Choose the wrong balls and you're screwed. You have to compartmentalize and see how each ball functions in the overall goal for the day, week, and month. What can you do today that will bring you closer to where you want to be tomorrow? Those are the balls you move. Focus on 2 or 3 of the most important tasks with an eye toward completion. Ask yourself the following. What can I make progress on today? Aspects of major projects. For example, if you are working toward becoming a real estate agent, you have to take a certain number of courses in order to get your license. It's different for each state, so if you haven't done so, find out what your state requires and then sign up for the courses. If you're taking those courses already, you might have to work on finding a broker to work with because that is also a requirement in order to practice as an agent. You need to contact a broker before graduating from training. What can I actually finish today? Important tasks that won't take more than a couple of hours. Keeping with the real estate theme, you can study for your courses or for the exam, do your real estate course homework, or research and send letters to the brokers you've identified. What can I get out of the way in a short, prescribed period of time? Must-do tasks like returning or making phone calls or answering emails. This is the time you take for administrative tasks, like returning a broker's call or any other short task. Time and priority management are as much about what you are not going to do today than what you are going to do. Examine how you organize your day. That means making a note of what you do each hour using a chart or pre-printed day planner pages broken up into hours. It's the same technique financial experts recommend for getting your personal finances in order. Write down what you buy and how much you spend. At the end of the week or month, it is very eye-opening to see how much money you actually did not have to spend. You gain a clear picture of why you have no money left at the end of a month. Same thing goes for time. Do this for a week, and you will see a pattern emerge. What you think you're spending your time on versus what you actually do all day. Once you have this information from your time deep dive, you can turn it into personally actionable steps. Rather than haphazardly adding to your workload or randomly putting off some projects in favor of others, analyze how much leadership, attention, guidance, and intervention each project needs. How much oversight is truly required? What projects and tasks can you delegate? You can make this a regular habit in about 21 days, a theory I discuss later in this chapter, the amount of time it takes to make most changes permanent. We'll meet people who have successfully reduced time wasting and now live balanced, full lives, and accomplish more, too. In terms of my own career, when I shifted my priorities from working as a hospitality consultant, a role I did and do excel at, to developing a television show, the way I used my time changed. I was now no longer just thinking about creating a television show. I was creating a television show. My priority became working on the show, not working on my consulting and thinking about a show. That is a significant difference, which led to a significant change in my behavior. Suddenly, instead of just talking about a TV show, I started doing what was necessary to make a show happen. I had a purpose. I shot sizzle reels, visual representations of my personality and the key concepts of the show, wrote a description of what the show would be about and who would be in it, worked on meeting and creating relationships with producers, and zeroed in on other activities that would bring me closer to my goal. I increased my output of tasks that brought me closer to getting a show on air. Despite all the odds, it worked. I did develop a show, and it was picked up. Bar Rescue continues to grow and evolve. Delegate. There may also be things on your to-do list that other people can handle more quickly and efficiently than you can. You may be wasting an enormous amount of time on such tasks. The first things to delegate are those that you dislike doing, that you dread and put off, or that you aren't very good at. This could be anything from ironing shirts, to transcribing tapes, to researching background for a business you're working on. I call these low-payoff activities that must be done, but can be done better by someone else at a lower personal and professional cost to you. That way you can focus on high-payoff tasks that you do enjoy and that have a larger benefit for you. Virgin Group founder Richard Branson, who describes himself as both dyslexic and having ADHD, attributes his ability to produce and innovate to delegation. As much as you need a strong personality to build a business from scratch, you also must understand the art of delegation, says Branson. I have to be good at helping people run the individual businesses, and I have to be willing to step back. The company must be set up so it can continue without me. Apply Branson's wisdom to your own life, whether you own a business or work an office job, by allowing others to take over tasks that take you away from meeting major goals. Many business people use what is called the 70% rule. I'm not sure who coined the term, but it's a way of figuring out what you can and can't delegate. If someone can do a task at least 70% as well as you can, and maybe even better, delegate the task to that person. In real life, some things need to be done to 100% perfection, but many tasks don't have to be, and 70% may be just right. If you can hire even part-time help with delegation, take advantage of it. That said, you have to trust the people you hire to follow through on tasks because the whole point of paying someone to do something for you is to give you more time to work on priorities, not less time because you are cleaning up their messes. I can't give you a seminar on hiring here, but briefly, rather than relying on job descriptions that simply quantify duties and correlating them with matching experience, I use a more holistic approach. I think of 8 adjectives and descriptive phrases for the person I want in a particular role, one to whom I can delegate tasks that have passed the 70% rule. What kind of person can do those kinds of things? This gets you thinking about an actual type of person rather than a faceless list of qualifications. Next, properly describe the role. When asking people about referrals or even advertising for someone in a classified ad, describe the ideal person with those adjectives. Keep the application as simple as possible, limiting requirements to the absolute minimum you would need before getting a feel for the candidate in an in-person interview. If a person's personality and interpersonal skills seem right, and I consider only candidate to fulfill at least 6 out of the 8 adjectives, then, and only then, her past experience becomes relevant to the discussion. That's because I believe you can train people to do a job, but you cannot teach them to have the right personality for it. Keep your list of adjectives in front of you when meeting with the person, and make note of those that fit. I use the 3 C's as the foundation of an interview. I have a conversation with her by asking questions that require expressive answers. I demonstrate conviction about my company and the job I am offering to gauge if her passion matches mine. And I show curiosity about her. Once you have someone whom you can delegate tasks to, make sure you are very clear about what you want done so the person can start the task and not need to ask a lot of follow-up questions. Set a deadline and some kind of feedback system, which can be as simple as asking the person to text or email you when the job is done. When I use my system of balls, I always attach one of my balls to a person who can help me move it. That way, we own the ball together, and it gets moved more easily. For example, my producers help me move the bar rescue balls. My writer Karen helps me move my book balls. My assistant helps me move my office balls, and so on. If you cannot afford to hire a staff or an assistant, consider hiring someone part-time. A good part-time person can often be found using Craigslist or other resources at surprisingly affordable fees. This is especially true if you live in a small town where stay-at-home moms and retired people, with a lot of skills, may be very happy for the extra money and work, and they are often very competent. Or leverage technology. Consider virtual assistants, people who live far from you but can handle a variety of tasks remotely, as another affordable option. There are also teleconferencing services, time-tracking tools, online invoicing services, remote desktop applications, online scheduling help, and many other internet-based services that can help you become more efficient and eliminate mundane tasks. Delegating may take some work, but it's very often worth it. Stop thinking of family as a time suck. I often hear time-related excuses around family. For example, I don't have time to work because I have 2 kids, or my family is preventing me from succeeding. Not only do these excuses keep you from accomplishing things you actually do have time for, they can also be very hard on family relationships, because people who use these kinds of excuses often allow resentment toward their family to grow. No matter what kind of job you have, your family comes first. Yes, it is extra work, but it's part of the package. I raised a daughter while doing a great deal of long-distance travel, including grueling trips to Asia. My daughter and I had an arrangement. She faxed me her homework at 5 a.m. my time, which was 5 p.m. where she was. I would call her and go over it with her every day. I chose to do this because it was the right thing to do to build our relationship and be a good father. And we managed to make this work across the globe before the internet and Skype made real-time communication accessible from anywhere. I know firsthand that the idea that you can't take care of both business and family is a lie. One bar owner I worked with, Will, thought he had no time to spend with his family, and his business suffered because he was too tired to really focus on what needed to be done. Will would get home at 4 a.m., sleep until noon, wake up, shower, dress, and go straight to his bar. I know corporate guys who work like this, too. They stay late at work, get home after their kids are in bed, go to work again before the kids get up, and repeat. Are they thriving at work? Hell no. Is their family thriving without them? Uh-uh. It's no way to live. When Will came to me for advice, we sat down and looked at what he was doing at the bar. Many tasks were a waste of his time, and we decided that other people could easily handle them. Now he leaves the bar for 2 hours in the early evening to have dinner with his family. He entrusts someone else to do the closing of the bar so he gets home closer to midnight, which means he can get up earlier and spend time with his family in the morning. Rather than saying, "I am too busy," say, "I don't have the capacity to handle every single aspect of owning and running this business." That's okay. Sure, you should know how to perform every task related to your business, or at least understand the responsibilities. However, that does not mean you should try to do everything or micromanage others. How can you grow and expand, innovate and evolve, if you are doing rather than managing? You can't. Once you admit this to yourself and change the way you talk about what you need to do, you can look for ways to change your day and your work style. Bullshit Buster, Peter Shankman. Peter Shankman, serial entrepreneur, founder of the journalist website Harrow, Help a Reporter Out, and author of several books, including Faster Than Normal, knows it can be tough to make time to focus on the hard stuff. In fact, it's probably more difficult for Peter because he has ADHD. Still, he doesn't allow time to get the better of him and has worked out ways of using his ADHD to his advantage. In 2015, he recalls, he was facing down a deadline for turning in his next book. My publisher was getting antsy, as I hadn't sent her anything yet. I'd done all the research. The problem was sitting down and banging it out, Peter says. Yet I wasn't worried. I'd been there before. With 12 days left until my deadline, I went to the United Airlines website and bought a round-trip business-class ticket to Tokyo leaving the next day. I got on the plane armed with nothing but my laptop, a power cord, and my phone. When the plane took off, Peter took out his laptop, and in the 14 hours it took to get from Newark to Tokyo, he wrote chapters 1 through 5. After landing in Tokyo, I went through immigration, walked outside, took a deep breath of fresh air, turned around, went back through security to the gate, and boarded the same plane back to Newark. I even sat in the same seat, he says. On the 12-hour flight home, Peter wrote chapters 6 through 10. He landed back home 31 hours after taking off with a completed book and his second bestseller in hand. When Peter tells this story to most people, they look at him like he might be nuts. After all, what kind of person would spend upward of $5,000 on a round-trip flight just to have a space to write in order to meet a deadline in 12 days? As Peter explains, he found a system that works for him. Being on a plane in a comfortable seat makes me a captive audience of my own obligations and goals. Peter knows he is never going to take 9 months to write a book, methodically spending a few hours each day getting a few thousand words down on paper. That's not the way he rolls. That style of time management doesn't work for him. It's not that he hadn't been working on it. The book had been percolating and forming in his mind for a long time. When he finally got in the plane seat, it all came forward and he was able to write the book in what most people consider to be an intense time frame. The quality of the book didn't suffer, as it might for someone else using the same technique. Because Peter's brain works in a way that is different from that of someone who does not have ADHD, he produced something good. Peter's story points to the importance of knowing yourself and using strategies that suit your style and personality instead of using it as an excuse to not get your work done. Thinking differently helps, as does realizing that what other people think of me doesn't matter, as long as I'm happy with myself, Peter says. I focus my time on doing things that improve my life. I'm a constant reinvention of myself, always striving for the next great thing. In the end, the goal is to create, build, and keep myself occupied with things that work for me. So I'm focused on doing positive things, as opposed to focusing on those things that could negatively affect me. That means using whatever tools he can, both digital and analog, to run his life and make it as productive as possible. I'm always discovering new strategies to up my productivity that don't include flying to Tokyo and back. Still, I see $5,000 as a small and very good investment in my productivity and success. A lot of people spend more money than that trying to get things done and don't come close to writing a book in less than 36 hours. Bullshit Buster, Jeff Gans. Jeff Gans, www.jeffgans.com, and I go back a long time. Jeff was 15 years old, and I was 14 years old when we were in a band together. We would rehearse in my basement. Jeff could play the guitar like Jimi Hendrix, with his teeth behind his back, even upside down. Even then, I knew he was an incredible musician. I was right. He went on to tour and record with such legends as Johnny Winter, Lou Reed, Tito Puente, Chuck Berry, The Village People, Rita Moreno, Jerry Mulligan, and many others. It's hard to imagine that procrastination could be even a remote possibility for someone as accomplished and enthusiastic as Jeff. However, he tells me it was actually the way he wound up figuring out what he really wanted to do with his musical career. Jeff taught himself to play guitar as a kid in the dormitory at a private boarding school. By the time he was 19, He was known as a very good rock guitar player and vocalist in the style of Jimi Hendrix and Eric Clapton. He later learned the Great American Songbook. When we were a bit older, we ended up doing gigs with a local band on Long Island. Jeff was an accomplished guitar player, but he didn't have the same passion for it that he had had as a kid, and he wasn't spending as much time practicing. When he was 20, he met a guitarist and arranger, who later became a famous film composer, who gave him his first lesson on the bass. At that point, everything changed for him. As Jeff says, "I did not want to know everything about the guitar, but I did want to know everything about the bass. It was a moment of clarity for me. It was clear to me that I was procrastinating with the guitar because I truly wasn't interested in it. Had I not become a bass player, switched over from guitar, and realized the history of music is as important as the music of the present and future, I'm not sure I would be as successful as I am today. After I made the switch to the bass, I did not procrastinate. I found the back meaning of songs. I was deeply interested in the music I was playing on the bass. Everything is different if you know the reasons for things. For me, knowing more equals procrastinating less. I am truly interested in what I'm learning. I want to be true to my craft. That's what motivates me and keeps me from procrastinating." Jeff went on to master not only the traditional upright bass, but also the fretted and fretless 4, 5, and 8-string electric bass, as well as the fretted and fretless acoustic bass guitar and piccolo bass. He's become a go-to guy in many genres and has toured the world with amazing performers. Not bad for someone who once felt he was wasting time in music. Now he has different reasons to avoid procrastination. "Being a husband, stepfather, and grandfather means I procrastinate less because those responsibilities make my mortality more apparent. I'm not playing for the same reason I was when I was 18. I don't feel I am competing with anyone. Every gig I have gotten, I have not chased. When you are doing what you love and being who you love, a lot of serendipity comes into play." It's time to break the time excuse habit. It can be done. There is a theory that changing human behavior takes 21 cycles. Actually, it was a plastic surgeon, Maxwell Maltz, who originally noticed the 21-day phenomenon back in the 1950s. Quitting smoking takes 21 days of abstinence. Changing a pattern at work takes 21 shifts. Learning to make exercise a regular habit takes 21 visits to the gym. It may take you 21 days to end your habit of bad time management and faulty prioritizing because those mistakes have become chronic. Use whatever tools you can to focus on what is important. Whether it's taking a long plane ride that forces you to get something done or being honest with yourself about what you like to do and don't like to do, it's now or never. You never get back the time you wasted. If you've been putting off a task or action, do it now. There's no better time. DBY to-do list. Value your time properly. You have 24 hours each day, and then poof, the day is over. It's time to start respecting the limited time you have by giving it the importance it deserves. Use your time wisely on things that matter and that bring you joy and happiness, propel you forward, and help you reach your goals. Delegate. There are things you are not good at, don't like doing, are a waste of your time, and could be done better, faster, and more cheaply by others. What are they? Figure it out and stop wasting your own time on these tasks. Stop procrastinating. Here's a quick version of my 5-step plan. Spend the first 30 minutes of your day working, not checking social media and email. Make a list and do the top priority on it. Break down big jobs into small ones, then do each job one step at a time. Remind yourself why you want to do it. If the timing isn't right, figure out why and do it anyway. Evaluate yourself on output, not activity. When assessing how you spent your day, look at what you actually accomplished, not the amount of busy work you did. This helps with rule number one, valuing your time. Manage priorities. Look at what needs to be done to meet your goals strategically. Make sure you are doing tasks in the right order, which is the order that brings you to your goal the most efficiently. Stop thinking of family as a time suck. Your family doesn't take up your time. Time spent with family is never a waste. Make it meaningful and high quality. It pays dividends in the amounts of joy and enthusiasm you have in life. Chapter 4. Excuse number 4. Circumstances. People are always blaming their circumstances for what they are. I don't believe in circumstances. The people who get on in this world are the people who get up and look for the circumstances they want, and if they can't find them, make them. George Bernard Shaw, Irish playwright and critic. Excuses based around external factors that cannot be changed or are difficult to change. Let's get something straight at the outset of this chapter. Unavoidable or unchangeable circumstances do not prevent you from accomplishing goals or succeeding. Some excuse makers think blaming circumstances, any external factors that you didn't choose but that you need to deal with, gives them a pass on facing their reality. If you can't find a good janitor, the thinking goes, then you don't have to worry about how clean your establishment is. You have no control over it anyway. You don't have to take the necessary actions to improve what's wrong, because the factors outside your control, such as the weather, or the greater economic situation, or the hiring pool, get in your way. Exigent circumstances may be challenging to deal with, but they aren't impossible to address. When you think that an external circumstance cannot be gotten around, you are engaging in magical thinking. I believe in God. But I don't think he's ruining my business on purpose or making it snow or rain to teach me a lesson. Magical thinking, in general, is an absolutely absurd way to think of your failings, because it's truly all in your head. It's a huge obstacle in terms of identifying fixable problems in your business and life. I cannot believe that anyone could seriously suggest that God wants us to do anything else but succeed. Just because it was a very cold winter and you lost money doesn't mean the universe conspired against you. Guess what? Snow in the winter is pretty predictable in parts of the country where it, snows in the winter. You can and should prepare for the inevitable and stop blaming luck or magic for your failures and indecision. To prove that the excuses of weather and other natural phenomena are all in your head, I'll tell you about one establishment I ran in Seattle, Washington. I would get daily sales reports, and on the top line of each report, the managers would record that day's weather and business conditions. In January, poor business was blamed on cold weather. If it rained, managers blamed the bad performance on rain. Frankly, hospitality businesses, especially bars, should do pretty damn good business when it's pouring outside. Where else are you going to go? One day I saw that the low sales were blamed on the first sunny day. I asked the manager, let me get this straight. The weather is an excuse when it is raining or cold, but it's also an excuse when it's beautiful outside? Immediately after that, I removed the weather and business conditions line from my sales reports and forbade the staff from talking about the weather. Weather is inconsequential to success. That line, in fact, made it easier for them to make excuses. Your job is to entice customers to your business and fill the place every day. I don't care if you work in a car dealership, a restaurant, a dress store, in the professional services industry, or at a corporate job. You have to stop blaming out-of-your-control circumstances for your misfortune. You can't control the weather, your competition, or the neighborhood demographics, but you can control your responses to these things. If you were in a region where it snows every winter, how about having a winter warm-up party or a heavy socks party? These sorts of gimmicks work well in retail and hospitality. I took the weather and made it part of our shtick instead of using it as an excuse. I opened an outdoor deck bar at the bar in Seattle. Everyone told me I was nuts because it rained so much there. We ended up having the most successful happy hour in town because we set up these really amazing huge umbrellas that protected people from the rain while still allowing them to have a great time. We called it Umbrella Hour, of course. It was a matter of taking a circumstance excuse, the rain ruins my business, and turning it into what it is, a predictable condition that can become a true advantage. Remember, almost everything can become an asset. I rescued a once popular dance club, Rocks, which had fallen on hard times after a California smoking law changed and patrons were no longer allowed to light up inside the bar. Rock's owner Scott Terhagen said this new law made it impossible for his bar to be successful because smoking was its key feature. How crazy is that? Yet that was Scott's excuse. Laws and regulations change all the time, and you must adapt. Scott used the smoking law as a crutch. Smoking wasn't the only reason people liked Scott's dance club, and not having smoking in the bar would be an attraction to a whole group of people who loved to dance but couldn't stand the stench of cigarettes. Most of the existing patrons came to have a great time on the dance floor anyway. Scott had to stop blaming the club's failings on the circumstance of California smoking laws. In fact, I say Scott should have seen that the days of smoking in bars in California were numbered. We reinvigorated the bar's dance club vibe by updating its look and playing up an industrial loft feel that was contemporary and unique. We also made sure the bar was cleaned thoroughly so that no stale odors remained. No smoking went from being a lousy excuse to an incredible asset. From 2009 to 2014, the bar thrived, and now Scott focuses on its two other branches in California, one in Norwalk and the other in Long Beach, which continued to thrive without smoking. When you hear yourself saying, "My physical condition prevents me from fulfilling my dreams. The neighborhood is bad. The demographics are wrong for my business. My location is bad. There are no good people around to hire. The weather destroys my chances for success. Government policies make it impossible for me to be profitable. My competition is killing me." It's time to face your circumstance excuses and stop bullshitting yourself. Take a second look. "It's the economy, stupid," is another form of "that's the way things are" thinking I hear quite often. It sounds insurmountable, doesn't it? That's an excuse you can coast on for quite a while. Still, anyone can figure out a way to work with the economic situation he is faced with. It's called turning an obstacle into an asset. David C. McCourt, the founder and CEO of Granahan McCourt Capital, is a telecommunications and cable entrepreneur and investor. McCourt says it's a losing battle to try to change reality. He cites the music industry as one example. He says the industry's threats to sue internet companies were based on magical thinking because they ultimately failed. Instead, he says, music companies needed to build an economic world around how people were consuming music. Instead of trying to stop the flow of content, which was never going to happen, the music and other media companies that asked, "How can I help sort through the noise of all that content?" survived. The question you should always ask yourself is, how can I take the existing environment or condition and adapt it so I can serve existing stakeholders and attract new ones? If you don't have customers in the conventional sense, ask, how can I respond to current conditions to elevate my ability to do my job? Even better is asking, what are the ways I can get ahead of the curve and anticipate what people will want next? You should be thinking about the future, not how to maintain the status quo. Media companies that shifted into the new reality of music consumption won, and those that didn't, or wouldn't, lost. What does this mean for you? You have to see unchangeable circumstances not as obstacles that allow you to give up, but as challenges and opportunities to try new ways of doing things. You have to stop thinking you are where you used to be and deal with the here and now. That often requires you to take a second and sometimes a third look at your surroundings and any changes that are taking place. Kathy owned a dress shop in a small upstate New York town that has both a year-round and a seasonal population. She'd been there for 20 years, and business had declined despite having a fantastic location. It's in a small, historic complex that was formerly a gristmill. It also holds a popular restaurant, bar, and a country store that sells local products and home decorating items. Directly across the street sits a large multi-dealer antique store, a pet supply shop, a yoga studio, and a busy pizza parlor. Kathy firmly placed the blame for falling sales on a difficult customer base. Ultimately, she decided to sell the lease and was shocked when 6 months later, she visited the store and learned that Lori, the new owner, had doubled her sales every month and was planning on breaking down a wall in the back of the store so that she could expand. "I don't get it," Kathy said to Lori. "Where do you find the customers?" "They are right here, right in town," said Lori. "I just figured out who they were and what they wanted, and I try my best to provide that. They love leggings, fun and inexpensive jewelry, scarves, kimonos, dresses and tops that can be layered, and items made from easy-care, washable fabrics." In other words, it wasn't the customers, it was the clothes. Kathy had not changed her clothing strategy since she opened in the late 1990s. The more formal, higher-priced items she had been selling weren't desirable to the majority of women in town. She never bothered to find out how the demographics had changed and how she might adapt in terms of her inventory. The first thing Lori did, before she even decided to take the lease on the building, was talk to local real estate agents about who were buying houses, young families, and who were selling them, retirees fleeing the cold for warmer locales. She studied clothing trends and walked around the local malls and her favorite boutiques to see what was selling. Once established, Kathy didn't think she had to do that. She thought she understood her customers even though they had aged out and left the area. Even office workers can overcome institutional obstacles. Dan works in IT for a large bakery that bakes large numbers of cookies, breads, and crackers. He had a great idea for a virtual reality tour of the factory that would show consumers how cookies and other items were made as if they themselves were in the mixing bowl and on the conveyor belt. He knew that virtual reality tours had become a big business, and he saw it as a great way to capture consumer delight and loyalty, upping brand recognition and ultimately increasing consumption. Dan developed a prototype for the VR tour and was absolutely certain that his boss would approve the idea. Well, his boss didn't like the idea, and his no was still ringing in Dan's ears when he sat back down in his cubicle. The no was a pretty big obstacle. But Dan was not deterred. He thought that maybe his boss just didn't like his particular approach to the idea. He looked at it again and tackled it in a different way. He knew at least one thing his boss didn't like about it, so he changed the way the VR tour directed the viewer through the cookie-making process, hoping that if the boss didn't like Plan A, maybe he'd like Plan B. However, Dan's boss did not like Plan B either. Dan was starting to think that maybe his boss just didn't like him, especially because a VR tour of a cookie factory, with the viewer as the cookie, seemed pretty damn cool to Dan and to friends with whom he had shared the prototype. Now what? Two no's in a row seemed like a pretty big obstacle. Time to give up? Third time might not be the charm, but it might result in a pink slip. Dan decided to accept the no he could not change and looked at it as an opportunity. He realized that the double no actually gave Dan permission to pursue the idea in other ways. He took it and turned it into two choices: develop the VR tour on his own, or use it as an entree to a new job at a different company. Dan took the second option. With good conscience, he pitched the idea to a rival cookie company, and they loved the idea, which is now in development. In addition, Dan no longer sits in a cubicle. His office space has four walls, a window, and a door. I don't know if this tour will ever be offered to the public, but it doesn't matter. Dan took an obstacle and turned it into a new and better job where people listen to his ideas and take them seriously. Remember that successful, excuse-free people work with what they have at hand. They research conditions and adapt to them. They take information, even if it is negative, and figure out how they can use that knowledge to better themselves. Blaming failures on outside circumstances or other people can negatively affect self-discipline and lead to more negative actions. This makes sense, because if you feel you aren't in control of what happens in your business, and you see bad things that happen as the fault of things and people you can't control, where is the incentive to improve and apply yourself? There isn't any. Harvard Business School researchers Christopher G. Myers, Bradley R. Statz, and Francesca Gino found that when there is an opportunity to blame our failures on external factors instead of our own actions, we jump at the chance to do so. Further, when we are unaccountable, we don't learn. Do you see how so many of the major excuse categories are interconnected? It's scary. Don't be a victim of your bullshit. This study reminds me of a guy I knew when I was bartending at Barney's Beanery in Los Angeles in the late 1970s. Hank was such a loser. He would sit at the bar and complain that the mistakes he made at work were management's fault. He couldn't make his quota, he worked in a factory, because the floor manager busted his balls too often for him to focus. Hank was docked coming back late from lunch because the commissary was not run properly and it took too long to get a sandwich. This blame game was old in 1979, and it should be ancient history today. If you blame external conditions rather than your own missteps and bad decisions, you're less likely to learn from your mistakes and make better decisions next time. That was certainly the case for Hank. He never changed his behavior, and last I heard he was out of a job. What a terrible, wasteful way to spend your life. It's hard not to take ownership of failure. It's human nature, after all, and sometimes you might be working with a team of different personalities and unpredictable factors, like iffy technology, or even natural events like a major storm that can affect outcomes. So how do you prevent yourself from inaction in these circumstances? Christopher Myers, one of the Harvard study researchers, told the Harvard Business Review that it's important to foster a culture where it is okay to acknowledge and learn from circumstances and failure, but without encouraging external blame. In other words, you can say, the weather is lousy, and I'm going to devise a plan so next time it rains, it doesn't prevent me from succeeding, and so on. It's also important to create an environment where failures and obstacles are seen as opportunities to grow, not occasions for dodging responsibility. Here's how. Always give a situation a second or third look. Re-examining existing conditions allows you more time to see things differently. Ask yourself what a particular obstacle is telling you. What information can you glean from the situation so that you can turn it to your advantage, like Lori did in terms of understanding her customers, and Dan did when he took his VR cookie tour to another company? Understand why something failed. Can you remove those components and go back to the drawing board with what's left? Come on, get happy. If you have a tendency to see all or most barriers as impenetrable to your success and well-being, you have to do a little work to change that tendency. Happiness and positive psychology expert Martin Seligman at the University of Pennsylvania says that optimists treat failure as learning experiences and believe they can do better next time. If you're not naturally optimistic, that's okay. You can actually practice being optimistic, says Seligman. Once you do, you will be less likely to see obstacles as permanent and the cause of your problems. There are 6 different ways you can practice being optimistic and less swayed by what you cannot control. 1. Stop putting so much stock into what other people think. Of course, we should listen and consider others' opinions, but we also have to understand where those opinions are coming from and whether what people say really holds true. If Kara Golden had listened to a major soda company executive when he told her an unsweetened beverage would never work because Americans will consume only sweet drinks, she would never have started her profitable beverage company, Hint Water. 2. Don't use toxic people and situations as an excuse for toxic reactions. You choose how you behave. You have control over your responses and reactions. So take charge of yourself. I believe it is the way you deal with people and situations that creates a toxic environment. We have to deal with people who offend, insult, and challenge us every single day. It's up to us to learn how to deal with these situations in a way that works for us, not against us. I am a proponent of bucking up and not running. That's why I embrace solutions and believe saying so-and-so is toxic or company X is toxic is the ultimate bad excuse. The word toxic gives you an easy way out, and I say reject it. This is based on my experience dealing with all sorts of people and environments. There are bad people, and you should stay away from them. There are bad places, and you shouldn't go near them. Toxic, however, is something you create through your reactions. There is bad, and there is good in this world. You will never be in a situation where you are surrounded only by or working only with your dearest friends and perfect people. That's not reality. I don't love every person I have worked with on Bar Rescue. Some of the owners I have met weren't nice people. But I can't let that stand in my way of doing a good job and helping the businesses and the people who depend on them for their livelihoods. 3. Learn from the past, but don't live there. Do not let past mistakes define your future. Don't dwell on what happened yesterday. Make the most of today. These are not cliches. You can't change the past, and you can't predict the future, but you can decide to do some forward thinking today. You can learn a new skill today. You can pay your bills today. What can you do right now to put yourself in a better place tomorrow? 4. Get out of the constant information loop. It's great to be informed, but world events are beyond your control. The news can often be disheartening, and frankly, the best way to make positive change in the world and create that ripple effect many leaders talk about is by turning off the TV or internet and getting out to make your business, your family, and yourself better. I am not saying you should ignore